Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations strongly condemns a recent visit by the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to the occupied Golan Heights. The United Nations says Israel's prolonged siege of the Gaza Strip has cost the enclave's economy an estimated $16.7 billion between 2007 and 2018. Also coming up, the U.S. President pardons his former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who admitted lying to the FBI over his Russian contacts. Welcome to World News. We're live from our headquarters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations strongly condemns a recent visit by the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to the occupied Golan Heights. Addressing a UN Security Council meeting on Syria, Bashar al-Jafari said the visit highlighted the absolute bias of the current U.S. administration toward Israel. He added that the U.S. continues to violate international laws by supporting terrorist organizations in Syria. Addressing the same meeting, the Iranian envoy slammed the U.S. occupation of parts of Syria and called for the withdrawal of all foreign forces that are illegally present in the Arab country. Majid Takht Ravanchi said the U.S. continues to loot Syrian oil and resources. He added that Tehran strongly condemns Washington's unilateral sanctions against Syria while the war-torn country is grappling with the coronavirus pandemic. Now, political analyst Daniel Lazar says the U.S. policy towards Syria under a Joe Biden's administration will be as tough as that of Donald Trump's. Here he is.
It's been amazing. The U.S. is responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths, for the displacement of millions, for an economy that has been pulverized due to the war. And now for a cutoff in an emergency medical equipment and pharmaceuticals in the wake of the COVID-19 crisis. So the U.S. aggression has been extraordinary. And the important thing, though, is that if Syrians were hoping for new relief from what would appear to be the new Biden administration, I don't think that it's really in the offing, because Biden shows every sign of being as tough on Syria as Trump. His designated Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, was a major architect of U.S. policy towards Syria, and his only regret is that he didn't do enough.
The United Nations says Israel's blockade of the Gaza Strip has cost the enclave's economy an estimated $16.7 billion in just over a decade. A UN report said Gaza's economy between 2007 and 2018 suffered severely due to prolonged closure, severe economic movement, and movement restrictions and military operations. It added that the coastal enclave has witnessed one of the worst economic performances globally. Gaza has been under an Israeli-enforced blockade since 2007. The UN report also called for an end to the blockade so that Gazans can freely trade with the rest of the occupied Palestinian territory and the world. It added that it was shocking to see that almost 2 million people have been left in that kind of situation. In other news, U.S. President Donald Trump has announced a pardon for his former National Security Advisor, who admitted lying to the FBI over his contacts with Russia. In a tweet, Trump said Michael Flynn has been granted a full pardon. Flynn's secret contacts with the Russian ambassador to Washington were a key part of a probe into Russia's alleged meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Flynn pleaded guilty in 2017 to misleading the FBI about those contacts. He was fired by Trump less than a month into his administration. In May this year, the Justice Department withdrew its case against Flynn. It said his alleged fabrications to the FBI were not significant. And Trump says his supporters must work to overturn the results of the presidential election. The U.S. president made the remark during a phone-in to his supporters in the state of Pennsylvania. He claimed that the election had been rigged to ensure a win for Joe Biden. This comes more than 3 weeks after his Democratic rival was projected the winner of the election by U.S. media. The president has so far refused to concede defeat in the November 3rd election, but has agreed to start the transition. Colin Campbell says U.S. President Donald Trump has a history of saying the vote is rigged whenever he does not like the outcome.
The president has a history of saying the vote is rigged whenever he doesn't like the outcome. He said that in 2012 when President Obama beat Mitt Romney back then, when he lost to Ted Cruz, Senator Ted Cruz, in the Iowa caucuses. He said that the vote was rigged against him then. Even when he won the election in 2016, he felt like he had won even more, or at least that's what he said, that he had won by even more than what was being reported. He also did not want to believe that he lost the popular vote. As we know that in the U.S., you don't win by the popular vote, meaning it doesn't mean if you get more votes, it means if you get more votes in the Electoral College. And that's how the president became president. He won the Electoral College, but his rival at the time, Hillary Clinton, won the popular vote. And even then, the president did not want to concede the point that it's possible that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote and he won the Electoral College, which would still make him the president, of course. He did not want to admit that either. And here we have again just a reiteration of the president's usual scheme. And there was an indication there. There was a big telegraph. He had been, and what I mean by telegraph to our viewers is a big tell. I mean, this is something that he had already put out there that he was going to say that the vote was rigged.
Meanwhile, Thanksgiving is the second longest holiday in the United States, with only Christmas being more important. However, many Americans are not feeling very festive due to economic disaster, the coronavirus pandemic, and a contested presidential election which is tearing the country in two. Rami Mazahari is in Chicago.
The United States is beginning its long Thanksgiving holiday consumed with divisive and ongoing questions regarding voter fraud in their presidential election. Incumbent Donald Trump refuses to concede, and according to a poll by the anti-Trump magazine The Economist, 90% of his voters agree that Joe Biden did not legitimately win the election. Last-second software upgrades to voter machines in places like Georgia. The unprecedented expansion of mail-in ballots forced by executive gubernatorial orders, which were not checked and balanced with a legislative vote. The fraudulent use of mail-in ballots. And other allegations, which many are insisting be investigated fully. So far, none of the hundreds of court cases have changed the projected outcome of a Biden victory, but many cases are still ongoing.
Yeah, I think there's some pretty convincing evidence that there is fraud. Could be on one side, could be on both sides, but it would be dumb to believe that there's no fraud at all. If they took it to court and they said that it's fair, then that's what I guess we got to go with. You know, I just want whoever wins, I want it to be who really won. That's all I care about, really.
Massive distrust about the integrity of the U.S. electoral process exists because this is their third disputed election in six tries. The pollster YouGov found that as late as 2018, a whopping 70% of Democrats still believed that Russia tampered with vote tallies in order to help Donald Trump get elected president in 2016. For 3 years, Democrats led investigations of election collusion, which didn't produce a single indictment, much less a conviction. In the year 2000, the Supreme Court ordered Florida to stop counting votes in what was seen as a highly partisan move which undoubtedly disenfranchised black voters disproportionately. The 2020 election chaos is unprecedented, and many feel it will produce long-term cultural changes.
I think it's affecting people because they're really starting to realize that there is institutional change. There's a shift in energy and, like, power is being lost and gained for other parties. Yeah, we were upset that Bush, some people were upset that Bush won, but I think there was still a privilege that was upheld when he won still, whether it was a favorable or unfavorable win. But now I just feel like it's really hitting, like, shit, things are changing. Things are shifting. Like, institutions that are no longer serving us are being dismantled.
Record unemployment, which continues to rise. More coronavirus-related lockdowns, which exempt some corporations but not countless vulnerable small businesses. A year full of political violence and a still disputed presidential election. Many Americans are spending this holiday at home alone and not feeling very thankful. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Nearly 780,000 Americans filed jobless claims last week as the U.S. is grappling with the coronavirus crisis. The Labor Department said the figure is an increase of 30,000 from the previous week. According to government figures, nearly 20.5 million Americans continue to receive unemployment benefits. The release data has risen concern that a renewed economic downturn is about to begin. It is expected that with the number of infections continuing to rise at an elevated pace and curbs on business operations intensifying, layoffs will likely increase over the coming weeks. The United States is the world's worst hit country by the pandemic, with nearly 12.8 million infections and over 262,000 fatalities. The states recorded a six-month high figure for fatalities at over 2,400 in 24 hours. Meanwhile, the coronavirus pandemic continues to take a heavy toll on European countries as the number of fatalities and infections keep rising. Italy registered 722 coronavirus-related deaths in 24 hours. The country's health ministry also reported over 25,000 new cases, taking the total caseload to nearly 1.5 million. The UK posted 696 deaths, the highest since May, and 18,000 new cases. And in Spain, there were 369 new fatalities and over 10,000 new infections. Germany, meanwhile, reported some 19,000 new infections and a record 410 deaths. The country said it will extend its current coronavirus restrictions through early January unless there is a dramatic drop in infections.
The restriction measures implemented on October 28th will stay in place until December 20th for the time being. However, both the government and the German states assume that due to the very high infection numbers, these restrictions will have to remain in place until the beginning of January.
Merkel said although the exponential rise in infections has come to a halt, the daily cases are still far too high and most intensive care units are still full. She added that there will also be some tightening of the coronavirus restrictions, including on mask wearing and social gatherings. Germany introduced the so-called wave breaker shutdown in early November, closing restaurants and leisure facilities, but leaving schools and shops open. The country has so far registered nearly 1 million coronavirus cases and around 15,000 deaths. Staying in Europe, where the European Commission unveils a strategy designed to make the 27-nation EU less dependent on imports of medical equipment and medication. The bloc has faced major shortages during the COVID-19 pandemic, especially earlier this year, due to its reliance on China for supplies. Jerome Hughes reports.
The coronavirus crisis has highlighted just how vulnerable the EU is when it comes to even the most basic healthcare requirements, such as having enough face masks. The bloc has also had to import ventilators and medication, mostly from China. The European Commission has just unveiled a pharmaceutical strategy aimed at making the EU less dependent.
We do not want to see never again the problems that we faced during the first weeks of the pandemic. Never again.
The plan is to ensure essential items are manufactured within the EU. The European Commission is also concerned that EU nations will not be ready to distribute vaccines when they become available in the coming weeks. Just half of the bloc's 27 nations have published plans. Countries are being told to redouble their efforts.
this means that member states cease to have the necessary infrastructure and the logistics, so when there is a safe and effective vaccine, they can roll it out and deploy it as quickly as possible.
Businesses are buckling under the pressure of lockdowns in many EU countries. The run-up to the December and January holiday period is normally their most profitable time. EU leaders continue to squabble over much-needed financial support packages for employers.
We've seen a major shock to the whole of the euro area, major trouble in Spain, in Italy, in other countries. I think the response was too weak.
Officials warn that if COVID-19 restrictions are relaxed too soon, hospitals will be overwhelmed during early 2021. It appears to be an impossible health-economy balancing act for governments. There is concern we are becoming complacent because we know vaccines are coming. Equally, authorities are worried too few of us will take advantage of the scientific breakthrough.
The European Centre for Disease Control says each year hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers in the EU refuse to take the seasonal flu vaccine. It begs the question how many of them, and how many people in general, will agree to be injected with a COVID-19 vaccine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And French lawmakers have recently passed a controversial bill criminalising the publication of footage showing police. The legislation, called the Global Security Bill, has drawn fierce criticism and sparked a wave of protests. We have more in this report.
On Tuesday, the lower house of the French Parliament gave its green light to the Global Security Bill with an overwhelming majority. The law needs to be approved at the Senate and the French Constitutional Court before it can be enacted. It would legalize sharing images of police officers with malicious purposes. It would also require the faces of law enforcement forces be blurred upon publication. However, it grants further freedom to police to record ordinary citizens without their consent. Anyone found guilty of infringement could face a fine of up to €45,000 and 12 months in jail. Supporters of the bill say it protects officers and their families and that it does not undermine freedom. However, those claims have failed to convince others, as the legislation has faced a barrage of condemnations and outrage from a wide range of people and organizations. Opponents say the legislation erodes freedom of press. On Wednesday, clashes broke out between security forces and demonstrators protesting the bill in the city of Bordeaux. Thousands of people also rallied across the country, including the capital, Paris, against the proposed legislation.
We will no longer be able to film policemen in action and to put them on the social networks, which is of course very dangerous because nowadays there is a real issue in France about violence from the policemen.
Amnesty International has lashed out at Paris for persisting with the bill, saying it sends a worrying message. The European Union has also expressed concern, saying Paris needs to ensure that journalists be able to work freely and in full security. The bloc has warned that it will examine the law to make sure it's in line with EU policies. In today's digital world, it's hard to imagine what would happen if people were stripped of the right to film potential injustices. In May, the publication of a video showing US police brutality against a black man sparked weeks of protests. The officer who killed the unarmed man was charged with second-degree murder and later discharged. Such a brutal incident may have gone unheard if it weren't for a passerby to record it on his mobile phone. The new French law takes away from people their minimal protection against police brutality, their freedom to film violence.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Basij, Islamic Revolution's Fruitful Tree. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. One of the obvious characteristics of Imam Khomeini was his foresightedness and acumen. He would make decisions whose accuracy and importance would be known later on. For instance, less than 10 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, he thought that, in order to safeguard the revolution and the country, it was necessary to have an organized and trained body. Thus, the Imam issued the order of establishment of such an organization on December 5, 1979, which came to be known later as Basij Mostaz Afan, meaning Volunteers of the Oppressed. Then, 10 months after this order, the Iraqi dictator Saddam, at the behest of his masters in Washington and Moscow, initiated an all-out aggression against Iran and the Islamic Revolution to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. In those days, the unique and faithful role of the Basij forces was revealed to all. Imam Khomeini said, "If we want to present a perfect manifestation of self-sacrifice, sincerity and love of God and Islam, who will deserve more than Basij and Basijis?" The outstanding characteristics of Basij forces caused Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei to praise them and use lofty words and phrases to describe them. Perhaps the loftiest phrase that the two leaders of the Islamic Revolution have used is Shajare-e Tayyebe, meaning pure and sweet-smelling tree. This has been adopted from ayahs 24 and 25 of Surah Ibrahim of the Noble Quran. There, God likens pure word to a pure tree whose roots are fixed in the earth while its branches are in the sky yielding fruit whenever God permits. Ayatollah Khamenei describes Basij forces with reference to these ayahs. "You, Basijis, are the sweet-smelling and pure fruits of that tree which the great Imam planted. This fruitfulness will continue. Just as God says, have you now seen how God gave a parable of a pure word resembling a pure tree whose root is firm and whose branch is in the heaven, yielding its fruit every time by the permission of its Lord? When the field is favorable and ready and the seed is pure, that plant is not terminable. I mean, no factor can harm it. Basij is such a sweet-smelling and pure tree." According to Ayatollah Khamenei, the sapling of Basij, which had been planted by Imam Khomeini absolutely for God's satisfaction, has turned into a strong and a sturdy tree with firm roots and ample branches that bears new fruits on different occasions. Basij has proved its unending potentials for solving intricate problems and removing various obstacles in every domain. This lofty status of Basij is originated in the divine virtues such as spirituality, sincerity, popularity, insight, religious awareness, submission to the leader, purity, humbleness, simplicity, inexhaustibility and constant preparedness for every job. Basij has turned into a role model for other freedom-seeking nations. Today, Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, occupied Palestine, Nigeria, and other places have learned the model of Basij in their fight against oppressive and colonialist regimes and elements. Principally, any person or group that works with pure intention for the sake of serving the poor and downtrodden masses, God will exalt it in the eyes of people. The characteristics of Basij were manifested during the 8-year holy defense in the best way. These characteristics continued after the end of the war in the form of helping the poor, assisting those hurt in different events, safeguarding the security of country, and health programs such as nationwide vaccination, etc. Currently, since the outbreak of coronavirus in the country, Basij forces have participated in a variety of activities to hamper the spread of the deadly disease and aid the low-income classes who have lost their job. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "Wherever there is a struggle, there is Basij. Struggle in the field of knowledge, struggle in the field of politics, struggle in the field of social activities, struggle in the vast field and great international arena. These struggles continue and will continue." Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader enumerates the features of this jihadi spirit, saying, "Work for God and as a duty, not forgetting the ideals, using all forces and capacities, relentless, inexhaustible and enthusiastic effort, trust in the youth and belief in the principle of we can." Dear listeners, the important point about Basij is to preserve and bolster valuable divine characteristics. Ayatollah Khamenei keeps stressing strengthening of moral virtues to all youth, especially Basiji youth. He reiterates to them to work without expecting any reward or even encouragement. Like Imam Khomeini, he highlights the principle that a member of Basij should work only for God. Insight is another characteristic of Basij. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "Dear youth, dear Basijis, wherever that you are in the country, increase this insight day by day. Do not let some material needs and paltry issues prevent insight. Protect your insight and know your enemy. The enemy has various stratagems, and that nation will be successful which is not deceived." On the importance of acquiring modern sciences and technologies for Basijis, Ayatollah Khamenei says, "Basij should enter the arena of knowledge ahead of all. You should go and capture the unknown scientific vistas, technological vistas, and innovative vistas." In other words, he believes that Basij should be equipped with two tools of knowledge and faith in order to be helpful in diverse spheres of services to the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Ummah. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, said, "I always envy of the sincerity and purity of Basijis and appeal to God to resurrect me with Basijis, as in this world I am honored to be a Basiji."
food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here is what the Prophet Sikh's infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said regarding the city which is blessed by the holy shrine of his granddaughter, Hazrat Fatima Masumeh, peace be upon her. Indeed, God has a sanctuary, and that is Mecca, the holy Kaaba. The messenger of God, Prophet Muhammad, has a sanctuary, and that is Medina. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, has a sanctuary, and that is Kufa. And we, the Ahlul Bayt, have a sanctuary, and that is Qom.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is Muslim Lady from IRIB English Radio, and our info is based on tradition. Today, we are going to continue the discussion on modesty. And we have in our studio Sister Salma Khalfan, who is in fact my aunt. Welcome to the program. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over. Inshallah, we will have a nice discussion about women, get to know each other better also in Inshallah. The process.
Inshallah. Thank you so much. Welcome. So, we had begun a discussion on modesty, so I hope we could continue on that.
Yes, I was discussing about modesty and modest behavior in general, which is very good, a character trait, both in men and in women. You know, modesty is like translated as haya, right?
Yes.
When, you know, modesty, it brings about chastity in women. Because of this modesty in general, the women feel like even being, covered in their hijab so as to prevent, behavior that would spoil the society, mm-hmm. all in all.
Very true.
So modesty brings about chastity in women, but modesty is good for both men and women.
Mm. Because many people feel like it's limited to women, but yeah. in fact it's for both.
In fact, even chastity in men is there, mentioned in the Holy Quran. Men are told, "Kullil mu'minina yaghuddu min absarihim." They are first addressed,
yeah.
you know, to lower their eyes because they have a you know, probability to look at women more.
Very see, true, yeah. yes.
So that's why they are even ordered to lower their gaze and also protect their modesty and their private parts. And then the women have an extra order here, that is the covering, you know. Mm-hmm. So, inshallah, today I want to discuss more about this covering, and, you know, some hadiths can be cited in the process so that we can, you know, authenticate this behavior of women. That brings about so much betterment in the society at large, not to mention for herself as well as her family.
Okay, perfect.
There's so much about hijab that we can do, like talking about the philosophy of hijab, the benefits of hijab, the importance of hijab, why hijab you know, is considered so important, so much so that some fiqhi principles have been actually foregone in order to maintain her hijab.
Mm.
And she gets the same reward for that also.
Very true.
That much important this chastity factor is for a woman, you know.
SubhanAllah, yes. I guess we don't know this beauty, so it's good that we should, you know.
Yeah, and it's good to even search for this kind of information so as to have this in mind, that why are you performing this hijab?
Yeah.
Why is it so important? You know, in every aspect, psychologically, you know, biologically, physically, mentally, spiritually, all these aspects, if you go and see, they give so much benefits for a woman.
Very true. And I think one of our teachers had said that usually we speak about hijab on what we think. So, for example, everyone gives their reason why they like hijab or why they do not like hijab. But we don't want to look at what we feel. We have to see what is the reason, the real reason, what is hijab in its own, you know, in
yeah,
itself.
Yeah, and what scholars have to say about it, right?
Yes.
After doing so much research according to the Quran and Riwayat.
Yeah.
And of course, what we feel then it comes after that. It's a secondary thing which is very beautiful.
Yeah,
I feel that
important.
When we've accepted it, then we begin to feel what benefits it gives to us. But sometimes if you're forced to do it, then you don't see so much benefits. In
yeah.
fact, you see a loss for yourself. That why am I covering? But when you know, come to realize and have this kind of information and the knowledge about it, then you do it so much willingly.
Very true.
And then, you know, it becomes very qualitative. And this act is a worship act. Act of worship. Counted as thawab for you.
Definitely.
Imagine the hot weather, if a woman is supposed to cover herself. Like for us, alhamdulillah, because we are living in the city of Qom and we have been in Hawza for a long time, so it's very easy for us, right?
Yeah.
In fact, enjoyable for us. But, you know, if we look at people from outside the world and they're just beginning to, you know, like perform this hijab, they might find it, especially if they're done by force, they're told to by force by their parents or something, they feel, what's the use? What's the point?
Yeah.
You know, people don't even look when you're performing or not performing, but they don't know there's so much, you know, effect psychologically. And in fact, if they don't even look, that doesn't mean that they will never look, number one, or they might not even have this instinct as in regard women as important anymore. So actually the woman should be looked at, right?
Yeah.
Like Allah has created her beautifully. So when they don't look, it's like, I don't care anymore. Now I want more and more.
Mm.
That's how the society in the West has become, unfortunately. So hijab is a beautiful thing to neutralize all that, you know, her sexuality, so that her real worth is on account of her personality, not her charm and her beauty and everything, which Allah wants to stay, but for her mahram, right?
Right.
Especially her husband. So modest behavior would be modesty in speech, in hearing, in action, in looking, everywhere. Haya means what? Haya is for men also, right? So when they are modest in their behavior, then they are modest towards Allah also, that Allah is looking when they're committing any action,
same,
right?
Yeah.
So in the same way, this modesty is to train us. Chastity springs out from modesty. But modesty, in fact, trains us to become really a God-loving person.
Okay.
So here in Islam, it lays a lot of emphasis in women being modest all round. in her looking, her gaze, which is mentioned in the Holy Quran.
Yeah.
In her talking, she should not talk softly with her men. In her looking, she cannot look at the eye to a man if she knows especially he is looking with lust.
Mm.
Even if she is not, but he is, then it's haram. Because she's making him look, right?
Yeah.
So she should avoid that gaze. And she should not even put on that kind of appearance, makeup or something, to make a man look. Even if she's performed the covering, and then the extra covering has to be there. The jilbab and the, you know, all these things that makes her appear so respectable, so admirable, that if a man looks at her hijab, it's okay. He's admiring her hijab, right?
Yeah.
And that's okay completely. Rather than looking at her as a woman, with those qualities of womanhood, which is only for her mahram. Islam is so beautiful, you know.
Yeah,
the more you think about it, it's so much, you know, to a natural disposition. A woman doesn't like to be flaunted. Even if you go and see a woman without hijab, does she like to be flaunted?
No.
She hates it, right?
Yeah, she wants to be her own self. She wants to be in control.
She wants to even move at night.
Yeah.
You know, go to the shops.
Yeah, unfortunately, because of this kind of, you know, showing off of themselves, this is what is leading to the problems of what's happening at night, for instance, that men are abusing women or anything like that. Because we have given them this opportunity. If they didn't know, if they didn't have this openly, then it wouldn't have, you know, triggered them so much. So now there are so many men just triggered all the time. Why? Because women are, you know, unfortunately,
they're giving way to that flaunting.
Unfortunately.
So it's very important that a woman realize her worth. And if she did so, she would change the society as well. Yeah. You know, if every woman was careful about this, alhamdulillah, we would have a society. And that's why Islamic regulations want a government like that, to make the women feel secure.
Mm.
And the men only go for the lawful.
Yeah.
That is their own lawful wives, right?
Yes.
So it's very important, the hijab, you know, means the hijab of everything. The hijab of the eyes, the hijab of the talking, the hijab of the action. Some women might be very good, like in their talking and their, like they might be keeping those rules of hijab, but as far as actions are concerned, you see them, you know, acting out and near men and, you know, with their women partners maybe. So man gets attracted to that also.
Yeah.
Or the way she portrays herself. Sometimes, you know, shaitan is so tricky that a woman sometimes becomes so emotionally, you know, like religious, and she may talk while looking down, and she may attract even somehow like that to a man. So she should be very, like, you know,
to be
balanced.
Yeah.
She should talk when it's necessary, not talk when it's not necessary, right?
Yeah.
And she should not bring up the talk. She should answer.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Even she should have those qualities of appearing to show her personality rather than her other things that are forbidden for her to portray.
True.
Right?
Right.
So the philosophy and wisdom of the necessity of covering and hijab of women in Islam is clearly determined from all this, you know. And it plays an essential role in balancing the instinct of this showing off of a woman. This instinct is there in a woman, you know, that she wants to display, and but that's why she has to hide.
So why do you think they're connecting this to freedom? Isn't it that women should, I mean, it's obvious that this is not real freedom if you really ask yourself.
Yeah, it's not real freedom,
so,
right?
So that's, they're just the like falsifying this, or
they're falsifying the freedom, exactly. They're saying that you'll get the real freedom, but in reality, the woman ends up to be so much filled with anxiety, psychologically disturbance, you know? All this thing happens when she gets that false freedom. Okay, you won't get that freedom that is actually meant for you when you cover. Okay, I don't want to cover because that takes away my freedom. Don't cover now, see what happens.
Mm.
You're actually not free a person.
They
you'll
look
always
so
be
like
bothered. Is that freedom?
Mm.
You'll always be looked upon even if you don't want to. Is that freedom? You might be even kidnapped. Is that freedom? You might be even used. Is that freedom?
Mm.
So all these things are falsification of freedom.
Another thing is that I also find that these kind of women, for some reason, are very proud and very like they. It's like that they don't feel shaken. So I don't know, when I look sometimes at people who are not in proper hijab, I don't know if you have seen that or.
They appear proud is because of the fact that now they used to do this life intermingling with the men, the society of men, and they don't feel anything, or they don't feel the regret in their hearts because it's coward in that way. Their hearts are coward. They can't see the effect, it's the bad effect that is bringing in them. They can't see, sometimes they are naive also. They can't see that they are being used. They can't see that it is disrupting their future also in return. Because when they get married, then if they do like this, their husbands would never, you know, like that behavior in them. You see so many fights happening because of that. You know?
Yeah, I think I'd seen one man, he was asked that, have you thought about marriage? He said, who is happy in marriage? Tell me, are you happy in your marriage? Nobody's really happy in their marriage. I feel like, why have they come out with this notion? Yeah, well, in reality, I feel like we have so many successful marriages, mashallah. It's just that if we follow the principles of Islam properly, you'll see that you'll have a flourishing marriage and, you know, a very good relationship.
Yeah, that's true, actually. It's sad that, you know, when we used to ask the men that would they like to marry, and they would be, I would love to get married quickly as possible. But now, because they get it out, they in the open, anything that they want, so they might even not, you know, feel like getting married. And then they ask, they give such comments that who is happy, for example. And then they dread getting married because it's like now it's a prison for him.
Limiting him now.
He has to listen to the wife and come home to her only, and he's excluded to one person. And because of these kind of ladies in the society that they don't cover, they make it so much disruptive. The whole, you know, system of the society gets disrupted because of this. The women out there who think that they don't wear hijab, they have their freedom, and yet they appear so overconfident and proud.
Though, of course, we do have some women who will say that they are not in wearing hijab, but their lives and marriages are going well and flourishing well, alhamdulillah, mashallah.
You can hardly find such.
Yeah,
number.
But I guess it's not so many, it's true.
It's very less. And also, such people, if you go and see, they are not very much interested even to show themselves off too much. They are very much balanced in nature. There are some people who wear very decent clothes also.
Yeah.
They're not in hijab. They wouldn't like to even, you know, intermingle so much with men and, you know, display themselves in any way. They don't like even joking around. They have their thing focused. Either their own profession, their studies, their work or something.
Yeah.
There are very few like this. But they are present. They are the ones, you can say, they are innocently ignorant. And those people who are proud and pompous about their behavior or not wearing hijab and yet getting their freedom and getting their way, they are actually naive, we can say.
Okay.
Yeah. They don't want to listen.
They need somebody.
But they need the hidayat.
Yeah.
The hidayat has to be there. We all pray for them that they get this hidayat.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, the hidayat is got when there's a government of so. Some people argue that what's the use of forcing people to wear hijab?
Yeah.
It's not for you only, it's for the society
it's
at large.
It's for the whole society.
Yeah.
Don't think
this
of yourself.
Not for yourself. For yourself, you know, it's okay. Just sacrifice yourself. If other people, don't you want other people's welfare as well? Of course, you want everybody's welfare in the society. We don't have to consider one person's welfare.
Right.
We have to consider everything at large, right?
Think of the whole society, a whole community.
Yeah.
Inshallah, that we are going to be able to implement this. And thank you very much. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. But inshallah, we will continue this discussion in our next program. Thank you, audience, for listening. Fi amanillah.
My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
minutes.
These days, we do most of our communication via social media. It comes in handy, especially during the time of coronavirus. But it isn't safe for everyone. This is why many young girls are quitting social media. According to a new global survey by the rights group Plan International, nearly 60% of all female users of online platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, have experienced harassment. This is what is driving young girls from across the world to get away from social media. In the US, 3 times as many girls reporting being harassed online or by text message than boys, according to the National Center for Education Statistics.
It's terrifying. As a mother of a young girl, I try to instill in her the importance of other things besides the way she looks. And I think if we as adults and as a society talk to our young girls about the importance of their mind and other extracurricular activities and other things besides the way they look, maybe we can make some difference. Maybe we can make a change. Maybe they won't feel as much pressure to judge one another.
According to Tamara, girls are not being put down by strangers online, but people they know.
Now it's not just, oh, the people in my school or the people in my class. It's thousands of people that go on social media and can see this one girl's post about this other girl. And can you imagine how much trauma that would cause that one girl, knowing, you know, one of my peers just said this thing about me and it's true or it's not true, but it's out there for the world to see, and how devastating that would be for that young girl.
According to the study by Plan International, 1 in 5 girls has abandoned or cut down her use of a social media platform after being targeted. Attacks were most common on US-based media platforms. Here are the statistics. Facebook, 39% of girls polled said they had been harassed, followed by Instagram, 23%, WhatsApp, 14%, Snapchat, 10%, Twitter, 9%, and TikTok, 6%. The survey polled 14,000 girls and young women aged 15 to 25 in 22 countries, including Brazil, India, Nigeria, Spain, Thailand, and the United States. Not too long ago in Australia, a child model took her life due to online abuse.
Thank you to everybody for the overwhelming love and support that the family has received over the last few days. We realise many people have travelled a long way to be with us today, and we appreciate everyone who came along today to say farewell to our beautiful daughter and our beautiful little sister Dolly.
In Germany, 2/3 of the children have smartphones by the age of 11, making it a hub for cyberbullying, especially the abuse of little girls. For years, international entities have tried to rein in the social media apps, almost all of them being large American conglomerates profiteering off of anything on their platforms. According to the British Counseling Group Safety Net, social networks' failure to tackle cyberbullying is risking the mental health of young people. The other problem is that kids aren't talking. Safety Net reports that two-thirds of British social media users said they would not tell their parents if they experienced something upsetting online. This prompted Duke of Cambridge Prince William to take a stance all on his own in this regard.
For me, the issue of cyberbullying and its consequences are personal. My work as a HEMS pilot, air ambulance pilot, has exposed me to the tragedy of suicide and the despair felt by those who've been subjected to cruelty and abuse. Through my work on mental health, I've spent time getting to know parents and children for whom the impact of online bullying has been devastating. And as a parent myself, I understand the sense of loss and anger of those particular families who have lost children after they were the targets of campaigns of harassment. I feel a responsibility to do what I can to help.
But more must be done. The United Nations says that leaders, public figures, and parents must all do more to protect children. Every year on November 20th, the United Nations holds an annual event for World Children's Day. November 20th is an important date for the UN, as it is the date in 1959 when the UN General Assembly adopted the Declaration of the Rights of the Child. It is also the date in 1989 when the UN General Assembly adopted the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Last year's event, the specific topic of social media abuse, was touched upon in detail.
I'm convinced that social media doesn't have to be a place of fear, bullying, and harassment. It can bring people together. It can be a place of love and support. Somewhere in the world right now, a teenage girl is being bullied online. She's scared, she's vulnerable, she feels alone. My message to her is this: you are not alone. There are people who care about you, and there are people who will listen if you reach out for help.
No one at that specific event blamed the large conglomerates for the child abuse on their platforms. Simply put, companies are not using profits to protect children. Even the Vatican took note of this, and the Pope called on social media companies to take action. That was back in 2017, and according to Plan International, nothing has changed. Shortly after Plan International published its 2020 survey, Facebook and Instagram said they used artificial intelligence to look for bullying content, constantly monitored users' reports of abuse, and always removed rape threats. Twitter said it also used technology to catch abusive content and has launched tools to improve users' control over their conversations. These methods have proven to have failed, as these platforms might be unknowingly encouraging abuse. Those behind the abuse are getting away with their behavior, according to the survey. For now, it seems that as young girls are catching on to the inaction of huge businesses to protect them, they are just shunning social media. This marks a new trend in an environment where social media and digital communication is being promoted for convenience and, of course, because of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. It shows that girls have simply had enough, and if world leaders and businesses aren't taking the necessary action, then they certainly will.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight.